Chapter 6. Kings, Shahs, Monarchs, and Madmen. Halfway across the world in the Middle East, the president's covert action advisors also had their eyes on Iran. In these early days of the Cold War, the Middle East was awash in spectacle killings that the CIA saw as motivated not only by politics, but also by religion and revenge. Assassination operations undertaken by religious fanatics were particularly dangerous, the agency believed, since a fanatic is unstable psychologically and must be handled with extreme care. In Iran, a group of these fanatics had recently succeeded in assassinating 8 high-ranking members of the country's secular government. They called themselves Fedayeen-e-Islam, self-sacrificers of Islam, Shiite fundamentalist Muslims whose declared mission was to rid Iran of corrupting individuals through assassination. In 1953, President Eisenhower's PSB met to discuss covert action plans involving Iran's Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh, who the CIA believed was at the top of Fedayeen-e-Islam's kill list. The assassination of a prominent government official creates a vacuum of instability, both actual and perceived. By 1953, when briefing Eisenhower on the assassination threat level in Iran, CIA Director Alan Dulles, a member of the Psychological Strategy Board, told the president in no uncertain terms that if something wasn't done about the situation, Moscow would surely take advantage of it. A communist takeover of Iran is becoming more and more of a possibility, Dulles told the president, and the elimination of Mossadegh by assassination or otherwise might precipitate decisive events. The result would be a domino effect across all of the Middle East. If Iran succumbed to the communists, there is little doubt that in short order, the other areas of the Middle East, with some 60% of the world's oil reserves, would fall into communist control. The CIA decided that its best bet for a covert action partner to counter Soviet influence in Iran was the country's vain young king, Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. The Fedayeen-e-Islam had tried to kill the Shah just a few years before. It was a cool, crisp morning in 1949 in the capital city, and the 29-year-old king climbed out of his limousine and began making his way up the steps of Tehran University, waving to the crowd. A man pretending to be a photojournalist called out the Shah's name. As Mohammad Reza Pahlavi looked his way, the assassin fired off 5 shots, hitting him. One bullet entered the Shah's face through his open mouth, passing through his upper lip and exiting his face without hitting any bone. As he fell, a second bullet struck him in the backside, wounding him. The assassin fired off 3 more bullets, all of which hit the Shah's hat, before police leapt on the man and killed him. As the assassin's dead body was pummeled by a vengeful mob, the Shah was rushed to a nearby hospital, where he spoke with members of the press. "A few shots won't deter my duties to my beloved country," he told visitors gathered at his bedside. The assassin's name was Fakir Arai, a member of the Fedayeen-e-Islam. By the time he tried to kill the Shah, the group had already succeeded in killing 2 prominent members of Iranian society, Ahmed Kasravi, a historian, in 1946, and Mohammad Massoud, a newspaper publisher, in 1948. Both men had been writing and publishing anti-religious pieces when they were assassinated. Their writings had deeply offended a central figure inside the self-sacrificers of Islam, a 49-year-old cleric named Ruhollah Khomeini. Though relatively unknown outside religious circles at the time, In the decades to come, this revolutionary cleric would become one of the most infamous villains in the Western world, known as Ayatollah Khomeini, the supreme leader of Iran. Fedayeen-e-Islam modeled their activities after history's original assassins, the Hashashin, an 11th century strike force of Shiite fundamentalist warriors led by the enigmatic holy man Hassan Isabah, from whom the word assassin derives. Like its medieval predecessor, the modern Fedayeen-e-Islam in Iran sought to target and assassinate those it deemed enemies of Shiite Islam. The assassins and their abilities, indeed, the very mention of their name, bred terror. They were deadly and cunning, rumored to possess invisibility. One of the first known Western references to the assassins appears in a report written by Frederick I, the Holy Roman Emperor, in the year 1173. They had a habit of killing enemies in an astonishing way, explains Bernard Lewis, professor emeritus at Princeton University, who first located the original reference in 1967. But it was the fanatical devotion rather than the murderous methods of the assassins that struck the imagination of Europe. Dormant for hundreds of years, the assassins were now at it again. The Shah's political ideology, the divine right of kings, was a Western concept the self-sacrificers of Islam vowed to destroy. After the Shiite fundamentalists tried to kill the Shah in 1949, and despite the group's clear allegiance to Islamic fundamentalism, the Shah's secular government, led by a prime minister, instead placed blame on Iran's pro-Soviet Union Communist Party, the Tuda Party, or Party of the Masses. As the Shah recovered in the hospital, Iranian state police arrested more than 200 Tuda Party members and confiscated the group's assets in an effort to rid the country of communists. The remaining members of the Tuda Party went underground. In Western media outlets, the assassination attempt was reported as being linked to economics, not religion. The assassination attempt came one day after 2,000 students marched around the Majlis, parliament, building and demanded cancellation of the Anglo-Iranian oil company's concession, that is, exclusive rights, to take oil out of Iran, reported the United Press. Half a century earlier, in 1901, a British entrepreneur named William Darcy secured from the corrupt former Shah of Iran, Mozaffar ad-Din Shah Qajar, the exclusive rights to pump oil out of the desert on decidedly one-sided terms. Darcy's British oil company would keep 84% of the profits, while 16% would go to the monarchy for the king to disperse as he saw fit, which was mostly in his pocket. Now, 48 years later, the bogus terms of the oil deal had become a legitimate point of contention for many Iranians. But in 1949, it was not oil that was directly related to the assassination attempt on the corrupt and ineffectual Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. It was religion. In the Western media, the Soviet Union was cast as the villain in the Iranian situation. Iran has been the scene of unrest since the end of the war, reported the Associated Press. Its vast oil resources have been a bone of contention between the Soviet Union, which has demanded concessions, and the Western powers, which have resisted Russian entrance into the oil fields where they have long dominated. This was precisely what Stalin warned Ambassador Bedell Smith about during their meeting at the Kremlin. 9 months after the self-sacrificers of Islam failed to kill the Shah, they succeeded in assassinating his minister of the royal court, Abdul Hossein Hazir. In an attempt to keep order, the Shah appointed a hard-lined anti-communist military general named Ali Razmara to be the new prime minister of Iran. In response, the Fedayeen-e-Islam dispatched an assassin to kill him. On March 7, 1951, Prime Minister Razmara was paying his respects at a funeral in the Shah Mosque in Tehran when a religious zealot named Khalil Tamasebi stepped forward from the crowd and fired a bullet directly into his face, killing him instantly. The assassination garnered the world's attention. Premier of Iran is shot to death in a mosque by a religious fanatic, victim of assassin, headlined the Associated Press. Just 12 days later, General Razmara's Minister of Education, Abdul Hamid Zangane, was shot and killed by the same group while standing on the steps of Tehran University, where Fedayeen-e-Islam had almost killed the Shah 2 years before. In response to the back-to-back assassinations, the Shah declared martial law. In Washington, D.C., members of the CIA convened to discuss next steps. The assassination of Prime Minister Razmara seriously worsens an already grave situation in Iran, warned a representative from the Office of Policy Coordination. Political and economic insecurity, combined with chauvinist and fanatical religious emotions, have produced an atmosphere extremely favorable to Soviet subversion. Alarmist or not, the perspective of the CIA was that the entire Middle East was on the brink of falling to communism. The successful assassination of a head of state can prompt copycat killings, raising the specter of chaos and instability, which is exactly what happened 4 months later as a series of brutal assassinations swept across the Middle East. The first was in Lebanon. As with most of its Arab neighbors, Lebanon had only recently gained independence from French colonial rule after the end of World War II. As per the terms of the United Nations Charter, the last French troops withdrew from Lebanon in December 1946. On July 17, 1951, Riyad al-Soul, Lebanon's first prime minister, was gunned down at Marka Airport in Amman, Jordan. The killers, members of a group called the Syrian Socialist National Party, declared that theirs was a revenge killing for the execution of one of their own party's co-founding members. 3 days later, on July 20th, King Abdullah of Jordan was killed by a Palestinian assassin at the entrance to the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem. He was walking into Friday prayers. The king, aged 69, died instantly from 3 shots to the head and the chest. "The king who made Jordan a nation is no more," a British newsreel proclaimed. "He was our friend, and for this he died." Standing at the king's side when he was assassinated was his 15-year-old grandson, Prince Hussein, hit by bullet fragments. The prince's life was saved when the fragments bounced off a medal pinned to his chest that his grandfather had given him earlier that same day. The assassin was shot dead by bodyguards, and a state of emergency was declared in Jordan. The king's eldest son, Prince Talal, took the throne. But Talal had a hidden history of mental illness and had been secretly treated for schizophrenia in a Swiss clinic the year before. After ruling Jordan for a year, he was removed from power by the parliament. Prince Hussein became King Hussein of Jordan, now age 16. He would rule Jordan for the next 45 years. Having witnessed the assassination of his grandfather by a Palestinian fanatic made the teenage King Hussein forever cautious of those around him, he later said, and caused him to treat his fellow Arab rulers with a degree of skepticism. He is said to have always carried a gun when he left the palace and slept with a pistol within arm's reach. After the death of King Abdullah of Jordan, the State Department sent a telegram to all its ambassadors in the Arab states and Israel, encouraging them to counsel restraint and moderation as it worked to shore up a secret partnership with the Shah of Iran. The killing of other heads of state in the region could promote a further weakening of Iran's internal stability, CIA analysts feared. And the result could be a general sense of aimlessness, insecurity, and frustration, highlighting Iran's lack of capable leadership, which is exactly what happened next. In Tehran, riots broke out. To appease an angry public, the Shah appointed Mohammad Mossadegh, an Iranian nationalist, to serve as prime minister, giving him authority over Iran's military forces. One of Mossadegh's first actions was to wrest control of the oil industry from the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, which infuriated the British. Mossadegh imprisoned the founder of the Self-Sacrificers of Islam, Nawab Savafi, which enraged the Fedayeen-e-Islam, who put Mossadegh on their kill list. Unable to kill Mossadegh, the Fedayeen went after the Prime Minister's loyal foreign minister, Hussein Fatimi. In what was sure to be a spectacular display of fanaticism and revenge, the Fedayeen engineered a plan to kill Fatimi while he was attending a commemorative event marking the assassination of newspaper publisher Mohammad Massoud. But the exact moment the assassin was reaching into his front jacket pocket to pull out a gun, a local photographer just so happened to snap a photograph of the killer, an image that would be reprinted in newspapers around the world. Adding to the uncanny timing of the photograph was the fact that the killer wasn't a grown man, but a young boy of 15. In 1952, the marriage of violence and Islamic fundamentalism was unfamiliar to most Westerners. And the idea that a teenage boy could be seduced into becoming an assassin in the name of religion was considered downright shocking. The teenager managed to get off only a single shot, hitting Iran's foreign minister in the stomach, wounding him. The boy was captured by the Shah's state police, who took him back to police headquarters, where he confessed to being a member of Fedayeen-e-Islam. In Washington, D.C., President Eisenhower approved the Psychological Strategy Board's plans for a hidden hand coup d'etat in Iran. A year passed. On March 4, 1953, the National Security Council convened to discuss Iran. Dulles repeated his thoughts on what the assassination of Prime Minister Mossadegh would mean for the United States. If he were to be assassinated or otherwise to disappear from power, a political vacuum would occur in Iran and the communists might easily take over. And if the communists moved on the Middle East and all its oil, it would mean the outbreak of war. President Eisenhower was briefed on numerous plans. When he expressed a preference for U.S. financial support to Mossadegh instead of getting rid of him, representatives from state, defense, and the CIA argued that to do so was useless. The days of propping up people who didn't like the United States were coming to an end, CIA Director Alan Dulles advised. Charles Wilson, Secretary of Defense, agreed. In the old days, when dictatorships changed, it was usually a matter of one faction of the right against another, and we had only to wait until the situation subsided, Wilson told Eisenhower. Nowadays, however, when a dictatorship of the right is replaced by a dictatorship of the left, a state could presently slide into communism and become irrevocably lost to us. It was the same mantra that had allowed the CIA to garner covert action authority in Korea and Guatemala. Diplomacy wasn't working, and military intervention was unwise. That left the president with his third option, the hidden hand. The president told his advisors that the situation was a matter of great distress to him, that he could not understand why we seemed unable to get some of the people in these downtrodden countries to like us instead of hating us. After listening to the president, the National Security Council secured authorization to proceed. The following month, on April 4, 1953, $1 million was wired to the CIA's Tehran station to bring about the downfall of Mohammad Mossadegh. The CIA plot to overthrow Mossadegh, codenamed Operation Ajax, took place the third week of August 1953. The details of the coup, even the basic questions like who hatched the plot and who carried it out, remain the subject of debate. Mossadegh was not assassinated, but instead arrested and convicted of treason. He served 3 years in jail before being banished to house arrest. He died in 1967. A retired army general named Fazlollah Zahidi became the CIA's frontman, retaining power as prime minister for 2 years. But the real goal for the United States was to quietly help the Shah assume absolute power in Iran. With military and economic backing, by 1955, the CIA got its wish. The Defense Department sent General McClure, founder of the U.S. Army 10th Special Forces, to Tehran to serve as chief of the U.S. military mission in Iran. His job was to help Iran build up its conventional military forces, as well as a guerrilla warfare corps. In a letter to his liaison at the National Security Council, McClure relayed what he'd learned. His Majesty's first and most important problem was the morale of the armed forces. Something must be done immediately to provide minimum housing requirements for its officers and non-commissioned officers, many of whom are at present living in squalor, McClure wrote. Like a kid in a candy store, the Shah's wish list was long. He desires a highly proficient and technically trained small army with considerable mobility, which could be backed, in time of war, by large numbers of tribesmen armed as infantry and trained to fight defensively until overrun, and then resort to guerrilla tactics. The Shah insisted he needed an arsenal of weapon systems and artillery from the United States in order to exercise dominance in the region. 3 battalions of Patton tanks, an anti-aircraft battalion to protect troops, steel mating for airstrips, 155 howitzers and landmines, wrote McClure. The Shah accepted the fact that it was too early to talk about being supplied with U.S. jet fighter aircraft. The Shah's military reorganization was well underway, McClure wrote, the country's charter being rewritten to move military authority away from the prime minister, so it was entirely under the Shah's direction and control. President Eisenhower expressed his approval for what was originally seen as a successful coup in Iran. The Soviets were at bay, at least for now. The CIA carried out a successful regime change operation, says CIA staff historian David Robarge. It also transformed a turbulent constitutional monarchy into an absolutist kingship, and induced a succession of unintended consequences. Not until the Iranian Revolution in 1979 would the most impactful of the unintended consequences be revealed. Scores of foot soldiers of the revolution seeking to overturn the Shah were members of Fedayeen-e-Islam. But in 1953, with the Shah firmly installed as the American puppet, an order seemingly in place, CIA officers mistakenly believed they could control the self-sacrificers of Islam, maybe even work with them. A new strategy for dealing with radical Islamic fundamentalists emerged. The communists were avowed atheists. The CIA and the National Security Council advised President Eisenhower that the United States should begin using the communist irreligiosity against them. In September 1957, at a White House meeting with the president, Secretary of State John Foster Dulles, the CIA's Frank Wisner, members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and President Eisenhower agreed. "We should do everything possible to stress the holy war aspect endemic to the Middle East," Eisenhower said. Dulles suggested that the CIA create a secret task force through which the United States could deliver weapons, intelligence, and money to American-friendly monarchs, including King Saud of Saudi Arabia, King Hussein of Jordan, and King Faisal of Iraq. It was an idea that would have grave unintended consequences. From these task forces, 1,000 monsters would be born. As was the case with many Arab rulers in the 1950s, Egypt's Gamal Abdel Nasser came to power using assassination as a political tool, at least according to his successor, Anwar Sadat. In an interview with Arab television, Sadat said that Nasser conducted a large-scale assassination campaign starting in January 1952, an act that helped him secure power and respect. After trying unsuccessfully to machine gun down a political rival during a military parade, Nasser led a successful military coup against King Farouk, which launched the Egyptian Revolution. No one liked Egypt's King Farouk. He was corrupt and ineffectual, vilified for riding around the country in his private train, consuming oysters, while so many of his subjects suffered from poverty and hunger. Spared execution, King Farouk was forced to abdicate, and he lived out the rest of his life in Monaco and Italy. Nasser became president of Egypt in 1956. The use of assassination as a political tool cuts both ways. In a region where assassination was as much about revenge as it was about politics and religion, once you tried to assassinate a rival, you could assume that your rivals were going to be coming after you. 2 years after taking power, Nasser became the target of an assassination attempt by the Muslim Brotherhood, Egypt's Sunni fundamentalist group. On October 26, 1954, Nasser was in Alexandria delivering a speech to celebrate the British military withdrawal. The historic event was broadcast live on radios all across Egypt and the Arab world. As Nasser regaled the massive crowd of supporters who'd gathered in Manshea Square, a member of the Muslim Brotherhood stood up and fired at President Nasser from just 20 feet away. Despite firing 8 shots in all, the assassin missed Nasser entirely. Pandemonium erupted among the crowd, while Nasser remained sublimely calm. He seized upon the moment for political advantage, addressing millions of Egyptians listening to his speech on the radio. "My countrymen," Nasser shouted, "my blood spills for you and for Egypt." Even though Nasser wasn't bleeding, the crowd went wild. "Let them kill me," he cried. "It does not concern me so long as I have instilled pride, honor, and freedom in you. If Gamal Abdel Nasser should die, each of you shall be Gamal Abdel Nasser." As the crowd erupted in cheers, Nasser continued shouting into the microphone, "Gamal Abdel Nasser is of you and from you, and he is willing to sacrifice his life for the nation," he repeated again and again. Nasser, already popular, was now also publicly adored across the Arab world. His vision for pan-Arabism, the desire to unify the Arab world from North Africa to West Asia, from the Atlantic Ocean to the Arabian Sea, could now take hold. In neighboring Libya, a young Bedouin boy named Muammar el-Gaddafi listened to Nasser's Monshea Square radio broadcast with supreme adoration. In school, Gaddafi would leap up onto his chair and recite Nasser verbatim. People thought he was odd. His classmates made fun of him. He didn't care. One day, he said, he'd prove all of them wrong. And he'd exact revenge on anyone who ever dared doubt him. Muammar el-Gaddafi would grow up, join the military, and seize power from Libya's corrupt King Idris. He would emulate Gamal Nasser, promote his ideology, and insist the two men become friends. 2,000 miles away, in Iraq, a rebel group plotted to assassinate their king. On July 14, 1958, the last king of Iraq, his family, his advisors, and his prime minister were all killed in one of the most brutal assassination and coup d'etat in modern history. The bloodbath was a terrifying mix of political killing and revenge murder, finalized and sensationalized in a sadistic display of mob rage. King Faisal II, born in 1935, became king of Iraq when he was just 3 years old, after his playboy father died in a car crash. During World War II, the boy lived with his mother, Queen Alia, in England. As a teenager, he attended the British boarding school Harrow, alongside his second cousin, Hussein, then serving as King of Jordan. King Faisal was 23 and engaged to be married when, on July 14th, the military stormed the palace in Baghdad. One of the king's military commanders, a brigadier general named Abdul Karim Qasim, ordered that the members of the royal family be lined up in front of a wall and machine gunned to death. Prime Minister Nuri al-Said escaped the immediate carnage, and the following day donned an abaya and sneaked out the back door of the palace. He was captured, shot, and his corpse cut up by shawarma knives by a vengeful mob. The mutilated corpses of the crown prince and the prime minister were then strung up outside the Ministry of Defense and hit with sticks. After the bodies were taken down, they were laid out in the street, where they were run over by an army vehicle. The corpses resembled sausage, reported a Baghdad newspaper, which ran photographs of the bodies and the mayhem. King Faisal II had been decidedly pro-Western, a friend of the State Department, and a guest of the White House during a visit to D.C. His 1958 assassination was a blow to the CIA's desire for regional control. The king had been a cornerstone partner in the Baghdad Pact of 1955, a five-nation alliance signed by Iran, Iraq, Pakistan, Turkey, and the United Kingdom in support of Western democratic ideals. The alliance, known as CENTO, was modeled after NATO, and promised mutual cooperation among its signatory nations. At its core, the Baghdad Pact was an agreement to contain the spread of communism and limit Moscow's influence in the already volatile Middle East. After the murders, Alan Dulles was asked to meet with President Eisenhower to brief him on worst-case scenarios in Iraq and how the king's killing might affect the overall region. Dulles told Eisenhower that a chain reaction downfall could easily occur across the entire Middle East. The kings of Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and Iran were all extremely vulnerable to assassination, Dulles warned, and if they were murdered, their weak governments would surely fall. Iraq's new leader, General Abdal Karim Qasim, withdrew from the Baghdad Pact and began forging a partnership with the Soviet Union. In 1959, in keeping with the cycle of revenge, a six-man hit squad aligned with an underground resistance force tried to assassinate Qasim. One of the assassins was a foot soldier from the village of Tikrit named Saddam Hussein. During the ambush, Saddam Hussein began shooting prematurely, drawing fire from Qasim's bodyguards and causing the plan to go awry. Qasim's chauffeur was killed, but General Qasim survived the attempt on his life. Believing they'd killed General Qasim, the members of the hit team fled. Saddam Hussein vanished. When he resurfaced years later in Egypt, the world was a different place. Chapter 7. The KGB's Office of Liquid Affairs. Through the 1950s, the president's advisors continued to see the Soviets as the cause of anti-American acts and sentiment they could otherwise not explain. At the same time, Moscow remained hyper-focused on controlling the public's perception of communism. From 1954 onward, the CIA believed that the Kremlin was behind a recent spate of émigré kidnappings and assassinations in Eastern Europe. Too many community leaders who'd spoken out against the Soviet Union were winding up disappeared or dead. For the most part, this was speculative. If only the CIA had hard evidence. The hit-and-run ambushes were brazen and bold, often occurring in broad daylight on city streets. Finally, in 1954, the CIA got the evidence it was looking for in the strange case of KGB assassin Captain Nikolai Evgenievich Koklov. Captain Koklov was a shy man, quiet and unassuming. His first career before the Second World War was as a theatrical performer. His special talent was whistling. Now, here he was, standing in a hallway in Frankfurt, Germany, a KGB assassin on a mission to kill. It was April 1954, and everything in Koklov's life was about to change. He rang the doorbell above a small nameplate that read, Georgi Sergeyevich Oklovich. Russian by birth, Oklovich was an outspoken anti-Soviet émigré and chief of operations of the Popular Labor Alliance of Russian Solidaris, a virulently anti-communist group in West Germany. The door opened. The two men stood face to face. Georgi Sergeyevich? Koklov asked. Da, said the man. Yes, I am he. I have come to you from Moscow, Koklov stated. The Central Committee of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union has ordered your assassination. The murder is entrusted to my group. I cannot let this murder happen. The target, Yorgai Oklovich, let the assassin, Nikolai Koklov, inside. Koklov sat down, presented his credentials, and went over the details of the plan. Then he begged for help. He couldn't go on like this, Koklov said, overseeing the deaths of people the Kremlin wanted killed. Koklov wanted to switch sides, to betray his country and defect to the West. If Oklovich were willing to help him, they both would live. And so, assassination as a secret weapon in the battle between East and West moved out of the shadows and into the public eye. 1 week later, on April 22nd, Captain Nikolai Evgenievich Koklov took to the podium at a press conference in Bonn, Germany. He announced to the world that he was an assassin for the KGB. A crisis of conscience had prevented him from killing, he said. The KGB was evil and had to be stopped, he warned. As proof, he revealed yet another Soviet covert action operation that had been carried out the week before. While Koklov was being debriefed by U.S. intelligence agents in Bonn, A second assassination team, dispatched by the KGB, had succeeded in kidnapping and assassinating an anti-Soviet émigré named Alexander Trushinovich, Oklovich's counterpart at the Popular Labor Alliance of Russian Solidarists in Berlin. At first, the CIA was suspicious of Kokhlov. His story sounded apocryphal. The more likely scenario was that Kokhlov was a double agent, a Soviet mole. But after a few days of questioning, Kokhlov's American handler became convinced he was indeed a KGB assassin who had experienced a crisis of conscience that led to an ideological shift. In the Cold War battle between the United States and the USSR, most defecting was done from east to west, which made Russia look bad. The Soviet Union spent time and treasure trying to control the free world's perception of communism, which is why outspoken anti-Soviet émigrés like Grigory Oklovich and Alexander Trushinovich were high on the assassination list. Now, so too, was Kokhlov. Adding to the drama of his defection was the fact that he carried with him physical evidence of the Soviet-led assassination plot. The weapon the KGB had given him was a cunning little close-quarters killing machine, a poisoned dart gun disguised to look like a cigarette pack. At first glance, the two rows of tightly packed smokes appeared normal. But Kokhlov demonstrated how, with the press of a secret button, a 4-inch-long dart gun sprang forth, capable of firing small, poison-tipped bullets into a victim. The weapon's delivery system was no louder than the snap of the fingers, Kokhlov demonstrated, and designed to be fired in a public space without notice. In Kokhlov's debrief, the CIA learned quite a bit about the unusual man, codenamed Whistler, including his intelligence activities during the war. When higher-ups in the KGB's predecessor organization, the NKVD, People's Commissariat for Internal Affairs, learned that the blonde, blue-eyed Kokhlov spoke German and could whistle, they foresaw an excellent disguise for a wartime covert agent. In 1941, Kokhlov was recalled from a frontline infantry unit, indoctrinated by the NKVD, and sent for paramilitary training, where he learned assassination techniques behind enemy lines. He studied infiltration and exfiltration tactics, reconnaissance tradecraft, hand-to-hand combat skills, and the art of silent killing, training similar to OSS operators. In the fall of 1943, Kokhlov had parachuted into Belarus under cover of night, where he linked up with Soviet partisans and oversaw the assassination of Nazi General Commissar Wilhelm Kub, the Butcher of Belarus. Kokhlov, it seemed, was the communist version of the special operations executives Jan Kubisch and Josef Gabczak, the commandos who assassinated SS Obergruppenführer Reinhard Heydrich, the Butcher of Prague. After the war, Nikolai Kokhlov went to work for Russian intelligence, posing as a German, a Pole, and a Romanian. In 1954, after the death of Stalin, the NKVD became the KGB, and Kokhlov was called back to Moscow. He began to have second thoughts about being a professional assassin right around the time he was sent to Frankfurt to kill Yorgai Oklovich. During Kokhlov's debrief, the CIA learned information it coveted. The KGB's assassination unit was called the 12th Department and was divided into sections, Atelenia, or directions, Napralenia, by countries or groups of countries such as, for example, the United States, the principal enemy, England, Latin America, etc. According to Kokhlov, the 12th Department headquarters in Moscow maintained 50 to 60 experienced employees and was headed by a general named Nikolai B. Rodin, who, under the alias Korovin, had previously been a KGB resident in Great Britain. Secrecy regarding assassination operations were maintained through careful selection of agents and the specialized training of Soviet personnel. The officers do not discuss their experience among others. Department documents are not circulated, Kuklov's handlers learned. If an assassination plot were ever recorded, it would be kept track of under the code phrase executive action within the KGB Directorate of Liquid Affairs, Mokre Dyela, also known as Wet Matters. The 12th Department had two secret weapons laboratories whose scientists worked on weapons for executive action operations. One of these laboratories, codenamed Laboratory No. 12, produced special weapons and explosive devices. It was here that the Soviets engineered and prepared deadly tools of assassination, from drawing up blueprints to melting and pouring bullets. A second lab, called Kamera, or the Chamber, developed poisons and drugs for special tasks. Stalin personally oversaw the creation of the Kamera lab, Kuklov said, which was located in a suburb outside Moscow called Kuchino. The laboratory housed a torture chamber, a place where death row prisoners were used as guinea pigs, injected with different powders, beverages, and liquors to test the effectiveness of various types of injections. One high-priority effort for the scientists and engineers at Kamera, Kuklov said, was to create poisons that would be undetectable in an autopsy. Only a handful of high-level persons were ever allowed to enter this classified facility. Kuklov had never been to Kamera, he said, but knew people who had. All assassins were trained in the art of kidnapping, the preferred hit-and-run tactic of the 12th Department. The Russian strike force units were called combat groups, Боевая группа. Each consisted of a Soviet staff officer, like Kuklov, augmented by a team of indigenous agents, local assets familiar with customs and terrain near where a target lived. On the mission to kill Yorgai Oklovich, Kuklov had been assigned to work with two German-born KGB agents he identified as Hans Kukovich and Kurt Weber. All combat group paramilitary operators were armed and prepared to perform executive actions when required to do so, either in time of peace or war, Kuklov said. The list of Soviet targets for assassination was long, particularly among the anti-communist emigre community. The members of the Politburo guarded a reputation they constructed for themselves and were determined to stamp out dissent. The best way to silence former citizens who threatened the facade was to kidnap and assassinate them. The assassinations of some emigre leaders are often carried out so skillfully as to leave the impression that the victims died from natural causes, reads a declassified CIA report. The individuals who died were reportedly victims of an apparent heart attack, suicide, fall, or traffic accident. Other emigre leaders were wanted for information they had. These people were targeted for kidnapping by a direct action strike force called a combat action team. The paramilitary team followed orders from the Directorate of Liquid Affairs. The CIA had a thick dossier on the disappeared emigres, to which Kuklov added several names. There was Walter Lintz, president of the Association of Free German Jurists, lawyers, kidnapped off the streets of Berlin in July of 1952 by a 13-man KGB combat action team never to be seen again. There was Bohumil Lausmann, an outspoken anti-communist Czech who disappeared from Vienna in 1953 and was later reported to have been taken to a Soviet gulag, where he died. The Ukrainian national, Valery P. Tremel, was grabbed off the streets of Linz, Austria in June 1954, never to be seen or heard from again. For his high-profile defection to the West and his refusal to kill on moral grounds, Kokhlov was featured in Time magazine and Life magazine and in a four-part series in the Saturday Evening Post, I Would Not Murder for the Soviets. When he testified for Congress, he made the Soviet Union sound downright diabolical. He spoke of Soviet death camps, brutal police tactics, and the machine gunning of citizens who'd gathered to resist totalitarian rule. Under oath, he swore that while members of the elite enjoy very good living conditions, the ordinary man in the Soviet Union is treated as a slave. Embraced by the United States, Kokhlov soon became the target of the KGB. To assassinate their former assassin, the KGB ordered scientists in the 12th Department, now renamed the 13th Department, to develop a special toxin undetectable in an autopsy. They wanted a poison that would first disfigure him, then bring about a long, slow, excruciatingly painful death. Not as much for revenge, but to send a clear message to anyone who might be thinking about betraying Russia. 3 years passed. In 1958, Kokhlov traveled to Germany to give a speech at a convention of anti-communist émigrés gathered at the Paulmengarten Conservatory in Frankfurt. During a break, he was sitting at a terrace café enjoying a cup of coffee when he became lightheaded. There weren't many people around, he recalled, just a few beer drinkers. Sipping the coffee, he suddenly thought that it tasted funny. Never mind, he thought, and got up and went into the conservatory's concert hall to enjoy the opera being performed. His ears started ringing, he felt nauseated, his vision blurred. Things began to whirl, he later told the CIA. Kokhlov staggered out to the parking lot, found the car he was driving, and somehow made it back to his hotel, stopping to vomit several times along the way. In the hotel foyer, he collapsed and lost consciousness. Taken to Frankfurt University Hospital, he awoke to learn he'd been diagnosed with a basic case of gastritis. But his condition quickly worsened and worsened. Soon, his entire body turned a copper-colored red. My mind began disintegrating, he recalled. He could not accurately determine if he was dreaming or awake. He lost the ability to count beyond 10. Days passed. A nurse came into the room, looked at him, and froze. Then she screamed and ran out. Looking in the mirror, Kokhlov saw that he was covered in black and blue marks. Patches of his skin were mottled brown. His pillowcase was covered in blood. My face had turned into a mask, reminiscent of a Boris Karloff monster, he remembered. When he reached up to touch his hair, huge tufts fell out. In Washington, D.C., the Pentagon received word of what had happened to Nikolai Kokhlov. The Defense Department swung into action, sending American military physicians to bring Kokhlov under their care. His white blood cell count had fallen from the normal level of 6,000 to 7,000 down to 700. Doctors took a bone marrow sample. His blood-building cells were dying off. The test samples came back. He'd been poisoned by some kind of radioactive isotope. Doctors gave him very little chance of recovery. Then, after a week of blood transfusions, Kokhlov somewhat miraculously recovered. It was the CIA that concluded that Kokhlov had been poisoned with radioactive thallium, a deadly toxin likely created by Soviet scientists in their Chimera lab. The poison had been engineered to work in a diabolically clever fashion, an analyst wrote, designed to produce an initial display of symptoms doctors would almost certainly misdiagnose as generic gastritis. The assassins, assumed to be from the KGB's Directorate of Liquid Affairs, had probably posed as waiters at the Palmengarten Conservatory Terrace Café, where one of them had slipped a few drops of radioactive thallium into Koklov's coffee cup. Just 1 week after Nikolai Koklov was released from the American military hospital in Frankfurt, the Directorate of Liquid Affairs struck again. This time, they succeeded in poisoning a high-profile anti-communist Ukrainian politician named Lev Rebit, killing him. The assassination occurred in Munich, Germany, in the stairwell of a newspaper office where Rebit had been working with a reporter to expose Kremlin-sponsored assassinations. In World War II, Rebit was the leader of the Ukrainian government until he was arrested by the Gestapo in 1941. He'd survived imprisonment at Sachsenhausen concentration camp, only to be killed by a KGB assassin with a poison dart gun in an office building stairwell. Initially, Lev Rebit's death was reported as being from natural causes. The autopsy that followed his collapse in the stairwell stated the cause of death as heart attack. But 4 years later, in 1961, a second KGB assassin, Bohdan Stashinsky, defected to Berlin, surrendered himself to West German authorities, who turned him over to the CIA. At a U.S. facility in Frankfurt, Stashinsky spent weeks in custody of the CIA, interrogated by an officer named William Hood. Stashinsky told Hood that he was assigned to the Directorate of Liquid Affairs, and that he'd assassinated Lev Rebit with a specially crafted poison gun, a tiny weapon with which he'd sprayed atomized hydrogen cyanide directly into Rebit's face. He described watching Rebit crumple over and die right in front of him. Unlike Nikolai Koklov, Bohdan Stashinsky did not experience a crisis of conscience. He was a double agent. In 2011, at the age of 80, he revealed in an interview with Ukrainian journalist Natalia Priodoko that he was always a committed communist and had been sent by the Kremlin to turn himself in, win the good graces of the CIA, and continue his work as a Soviet mole. Bohdan Stashinsky served 8 years in a German prison for the murder of Lev Rebit. This light sentence was likely a result of the lie he propagated, that he couldn't bear to be an assassin and instead turned himself in. After Stashinsky's release in 1966, he went to Washington to work with the CIA. But they suspected a double game, he says, and he was sent to a backwater post in Panama. After a few years with no access to anything important, Stashinsky was extracted and transported to Paraguay by the KGB. He went to Africa, had plastic surgery so the CIA couldn't find him, and returned to the USSR in 1970. The CIA's files on Bohdan Stashinsky remain classified. In Moscow, the KGB opened two new divisions inside its Directorate of Liquid Affairs. Department T, for terrorism, oversaw assassinations by shooting, poisoning, blowing things up, and subversion. Department V, for victory, kept track of its assassins' successes. The new name for work being done by Department T was now Direct Action, declassified CIA documents reveal.